This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In Podcast Network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
So I'm staying in my own chair. Go on without me if you must. So many shows on Netflix. And even more on Hulu Plus. Nonstop solid entertainment. Till my body turns to dust. TV is awesome!
Hosts Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to episode 25 of TV Good Sleep Bad, your monthly dose of cult TV goodness. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones, from the depths of DVD hell, and joining me as always is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Hold on a second. I think my socks come to life. I gotta get it. I gotta track it down. Hold on a second.
On tonight's show, we will be meeting the world's deadliest assassin in Aeon Flux, before meeting the students who are perhaps more dangerous to themselves as we revisit the legendary Brit comedy, The Young Ones. And, I mean, obviously, Lucky, since the last episode, I mean, what's obviously been holding your interest? I think that's probably the best place to start, because we've got two very unique visions on tonight's show, and yet they're very much of the period that they were released. So, I mean, before we obviously dive into those, I mean, what has sort of been currently holding your interest?
Not really a whole lot. Well, the Olympics. All my television has been on hold since the Olympics. Other than that, I've been slowly grinding through the new season of Black Mirror, slowly grinding through Gotham. I got to get back into Gotham. The X-Files went on hiatus for the Olympics.
Yeah.
This week's episode was really good. Probably the best episode not written by Darren Morgan. Co-written by Kristen Cloak, who is executive producer Glenn Morgan's wife and also starred on Millennium. And it was just a really... really interesting episode. So when it gets over to you guys, I'm kind of interested in what you guys think of it.
Yeah. I mean, we finally got the X-Files over here. I've only actually watched the first couple of episodes. We've had the first four, and I've watched the first two. My struggle, I don't think people should judge the season on my struggle three.
Oh, God, no. Oh, hell
that was,
no.
And the attempts, the last gasps to keep the conspiracy going, it's sort of like, you can tell it's sort of like there's nothing left in the box. And they just basically pull the most stupidest thing out and throw it at the screen and go, let's try this.
It's you know, Chris Carter has kind of painted himself into a corner. He painted himself into a corner, obviously, back with the original series. But the problem now that he has when trying to reintroduce this whole thing now is, how do you do conspiracies in a world that contains Mr. Robot? How do you do things like cloning and things like that in a world that contains stuff like, Orphan Black? You know, there's all this stuff, and it's the X-Files is kind of in the not particularly envious position of trying to kind of figure out what it does best in a world where a lot of kind of the stuff that it did best back in the 90s, it's been surpassed at, and trying to kind of find a new niche for itself. With a couple of the episodes, I think they do, they have kind of a new way. There are maybe some points to a new way, of doing things, but I just I'm interested to see where this season goes. Whether or not it's going to be the last, because Gillian Anderson has said she's not doing any more X-Files. He's not going to play Scully again, and Carter saying he's not going to do it without Scully. But there's been some really interesting stuff. This has definitely been a better season than season 10. Darren Morgan's episode this season, the Lost Art of Forehead Sweat, really, I think, kind of gets kind of like a lot of interesting things about, you know, how do you do a show whose tagline, ostensible tagline, is the truth is out there, in a thing, you know, in an environment where, you know, you have the President of the United States can basically say one thing one day and the next day say he never said that and never get called on it. It's almost like we live in like a post-truth atmosphere, you know, and I felt that, you know, the Lost Art of Forehead Sweat really, really addressed that in a very entertainingly Darren Morgan-esque manner.
Yeah.
And like I said, the most recent episode, it's some scrambled sort of base 64 encrypted title, which kind of deals with, it starts by telling the story of the Microsoft Twitter chatbot. From a couple of years ago that went online and, you know, 12 hours later was, you know, basically asking Danny to do her up the button, heiling Hitler, and then kind of goes from there. And these are kind of really, I mean, it's really, you know, probably the, I think I like the Darren Morgan episodes better, but it's really about the freshest and newest episode that the show has done, you know, since the revival. I mean, you've had the other things. I mean, there's, you know, you've had the typical, you've seen the second episode, so you know one of the topics they tackle is the good old tried and true, this is really, life is really a simulation theory.
Yeah.
Jim Wong's episode, I think it's Jim Wong, could be Glenn Morgan or Wong, but the other one, did something that's got some, an episode that's a little bit, I think, inspired by like the two girls who went nuts and stabbed each other over Slenderman type stuff. So it's you know, like creepypasta, urban legends, stuff like that. But it's, so I think we've got some interesting stuff here. But this is the problem with the show, the original show, is that, you know, how much further can you go with the Smoking Man and aliens and whatever the hell else just this whole thing is, you know, it's just, I love you, Bill Davis, but it's, that's over and done with, you know?
Yeah. I'm finding that my enjoyment from the show is more coming from the one-offs. Like, I still like following these characters. I still like the characters of Mulder and Scully, and I like them being given a different mystery. That's the thing. I like the standalone mystery still. I think there's still some interesting ideas coming through. Certainly, this most recent episode has given us probably one of the more interestingly most requested props ever in Scully's vibrator.
Yeah!
A mystery that Gillian Anderson solved herself by posting the link where you can buy your own. So,
buy your own Scully vibrator.
And, certainly when I've seen the promos of the next one that we got coming up, and we've got, like, those masks which are very reminiscent of, Argento's Deep Red. They remind me of the puppet.
I actually would say they just remind me of the Purge.
That as well.
People running around in masks, that's the Purge. But yeah, the little creepy doll mask from Deep Red, yeah.
I mean, I'm a sucker for a good mask. I mean, I love the mask in The Strangers. I love the Purge. So give me a decent looking oddball mask and I'm pretty much there. So I'm still with the show. I mean, as I said, I'm still with the show. I'm not with the conspiracy, but I'm happy that the show still give me a reason to tune in still.
It's if the price I have to pay for, you know, a good fun episode like this or Forehead Sweat or the most recent one is My Struggle Part whatever, you know, I guess I'll take it.
Yeah.
because I love the characters. I love watching the characters, and I every so often they'll do something that's you know they'll get a plot in there that's just so it's good fun.
Mm, definitely. I mean, just also to briefly touch on Black Mirror, which you mentioned already. I think this latest season of Black Mirror has one of my all-time favorite episodes, which is the episode Black Museum.
I haven't gotten to that one yet. The only two I haven't seen, I haven't seen that one, and I haven't seen, I think it's Hang the DJ.
Okay.
The one with the Smiths title. Those are the last two I need to watch. I've watched everything else.
Yeah.
I've heard some stuff about Black Museum. That makes it sound really interesting, but I haven't actually watched it yet.
Okay. I mean, Black Museum is the anthology one, much like White Christmas. I'm not going to go into anything else about it. The most interesting part for myself is the fact that Penn of Penn and Teller actually wrote one of the segments.
Oh!
Continuing his running theme of turning up in interesting places. I mean, he turns up in Hackers. I didn't know he wrote a computer column until you told me about that.
Oh yeah, I told you about that. He wrote the computer pro. I remember one of the things he wrote, I think it was in PC Magazine, he said the absolute thing you do not do when you're taking your laptop to the airport, you do not put a new autoexec.bat file on your DOS that goes so when they turn it on that it does not print arming bomb. Counting down 10, 9. You don't do that.
And I mean, he's written the diet book as well recently. So I mean, he keeps turning up in interesting places.
He always has. I mean, I was a few months ago. I watched a movie called The Theory of Obscurity, which is about the San Francisco avant-garde quote-unquote rock band The Residents, and he actually Penn Jillette actually toured with them in like the late 70s and early 80s when they started touring and doing these sort of conceptual stage shows. He would go and narrate them, and he had they had these interviews of him that would date back in this film to like 78 79 80, and I'm like, wow, I barely recognized him.
It's weird. Whenever I think, this is the thing, and I don't know if you're going to take it as a compliment or an insult, Lucky, but whenever I see Penn Jillette or Lewis Black, my mind instantly goes to yourself. I don't know. Those two people just instantly make me think of Lucky. I don't know why, but.
I have the tendency, I think, to go on a Lewis Blackish rant, I think, from time to time. And I don't know. I'll take it as a compliment, even though I don't. I'm pretty much a democratic socialist, and Penn Jillette's very much a libertarian. I don't agree with Penn Jillette's politics, but they're both funny men, and they're both intelligent men. And they're both entertaining people. I'll take that as a compliment.
You see, this is our goal for the show. Now we've got the thatmomentin.com Deutschmarks coming in. We're gonna That's what we're gonna do. It's going to be the round table, it's going to be us, and we're gonna get Penn Jillette and Lewis Black in, and it's going to be like just blow everyone's minds. That's the round table I want.
Nobody's gonna be able to tell between the three of us, and we'll talk so loud we'll form a black hole. The whole thing, the whole world, universe will collapse.
It'd be an audio onslaught.
Fun stuff.
Definitely.
Fun for all ages.
Something that perhaps wasn't as fun as it should have been was Netflix's latest series, Everything Sucks. Also, for myself, it felt pretty much like Freaks and Geeks 2.0. This is Netflix trying to cash in on the whole 90s buzz at the moment. And, you know, I mean, this didn't suck, but it was kind of middle of the road. And if I have to hear someone re-churn the, oh, why Alanis Morissette's ironic isn't ironic, again, I'm just going to go and shoot myself in the head. But, I don't know. I think there's worse ways you can spend your time, but...
What is this Everything Sucks? You make it sound like... You make it sound like a VH1 I Love the 90s special. Is Michael Ian Black involved in some way or another?
No, I mean, Everything Sucks is it's set in the middle of the 90s. It's basically based around these three, based around these two groups, you've got the AV Club and the Drama Club. And basically, you've got this young freshman who has just joined the AV Club with his two friends. And he's got this crush on this girl called Kate Mesner, who's also the daughter of the principal. And he sets up this whole sort of scheme to try and win her. However, at the same time, she's recently discovered her sexual awakening and turns out that she's actually a lesbian. So we have this interesting dynamic between them, where he's acting as her boyfriend and she's trying to come to terms of, well, what she's all about. I mean, is she gay? Is it just a phase? What's it about? And that's probably the most interesting aspect of the show. The downside is that the lead character, Luke, played by Jahao Diallo Winston, is so bipolar as a character. It's so hard to like for him. When he's in a good mood, he's very charming, but if something doesn't go his way, he acts like the most spoiled brat and then goes psychotic. He's like you're watching a mini Spike Lee.
Boy!
He just goes off of these rants that you're how are we supposed to like this character who's just basically throwing a tantrum because they haven't got their own way? And yeah, I mean, there's a certain amount of nostalgia for folks like myself whose era was the 90s. So it's fun to see some of the aspects of it, you know, fashions and music references. And there's a really interesting part in one of the things, the first or second episode, where he basically puts together this video to try and ask her out. And it's basically him reenacting famous videos from the 90s. So you've got the Last Morissette's Ironic video, Oasis Wonderwall, and a couple of other ones in there as well. And it's just, I think that was the most interesting part of the whole series, them doing this Be Kind Rewind style reimagining of these videos.
Do they do Jamiroquai's Virtual Insanity?
No, that would have been really awesome to see.
That would have been really awesome. That's one of my favorite 90s videos.
They do You Gotta Be. I can't remember.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember her name.
Yeah.
That's a good song, though.
But they do the bit where the last one says where her double is supposed to be holding hands, and because there's only the one black kid, you see this white hand go across instead. But yeah, I mean, I binged it in 2 days, and it was interesting enough, but at the same time, it was sort of there was just so many annoying character flaws, and the fact that at times it just felt like they were trying to rip off Freaks and Geeks, and I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, I can just go and watch Freaks and Geeks instead.
Right.
Which is never a good thing if you're thinking, oh, I can just watch another show instead.
Right.
The other show on Netflix that's been holding my interest, and this was actually recommended by Kim over on Game Warp, and that is the Hong Kong series OCTB, which is a triad crime drama. It's set during the handover of Hong Kong to China. As you've got this undercover police officer who's infiltrating the local triad set, and it's just basically about him trying to take down this triad set from the inside. It takes a little bit of time to go. It's a bit of a slow paced series, but by the end of the first episode, I was absolutely hooked on the show. And you got to take into account the fact it is a Hong Kong series, so the film stock's different, and certainly the style of dialogue and pacing is a lot different as well. But it's actually a series really worth checking out. And the fact it's on Netflix, it's hidden amongst their foreign language dramas. It makes it easy to access, which is always nice as well.
Uh-huh.
Speaking of recommendations, I actually finally got around to seeing the show that I've been saying to you I'm going to watch. I think from way back on episode one, and I started watching The Americans.
Yeah.
And that's really good as well.
Yeah, I told you.
I know. I can't believe I watched it sooner. I mean, I'm only...
I have excellent taste. I keep telling you this.
I'm three episodes in, and For some reason, I thought it was like 1970s set, but it's actually 1980s it's set.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes sense. But
They do a bit of a fake out. I think in the early on the first episode where they set the one chase scene to Tusk.
Yes.
Which was 79. But it's an awesome song, so I'll let it slide.
And I like the fact that it covers for itself very well. The fact that the obviously Russian agents infiltrate in America, and you think, oh, why they haven't got Russian accents? And you find out from obviously like the agency investigating, it's like, you know, these agents have been trained so that when they come over to America, they don't speak a word of Russian, and that they speak English better than Americans do.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, you're clarifying why all these questions I have as I'm sort of coming to me. And obviously in this early episode, the fact you have the discussion between these two agents and they're talking about how they wanted to put an interrogation, one of them wanted to put an interrogation room beneath the house and that they opted not to because they couldn't find a way to cover it up. But as I said, there's just so many interesting dynamics and like the flashbacks to their training in Russia. It's really, really, really interesting, and I'm really enjoying it so far. I mean, I think the first four seasons are on Amazon Prime at the moment, so I'm slowly working my way through them. And it's just one of those shows, though, I like to sort of sit down and watch without people asking me for things every 5 seconds, or if there's chaos erupting in the house. So it's a little harder to try and find the time for, but it's definitely a show that's worth discovering and checking out if you haven't done already.
Right.
It's just a shame that, you know, Amazon don't make a bigger deal of their series as, like, say, Netflix do.
Yeah.
The Amazon Prime model is just very, very weird when it comes to its video. The fact that nothing ever seems to be highlighted. Their original shows never seem to be as exciting as the Netflix original shows. Which makes it a harder platform to sort of get into. So it's always kind of fascinating when I stumble across the things I do stumble across on there, so.
Right.
But, I will let you know how that goes. And I will eventually get around to watching Gotham Season 3, because we did actually get a message on the Facebook group about Season 3. And, it's still to be shown on Channel 5. I think we're on Season 5 in the US. So, if it's ever going to show up on Channel 5, I do not know. But you can watch it on Netflix at the minute, so I think I need to get back into it because I missed.
It's showing in Britain on the Snowpiercer channel.
Yeah, that black hole. Where...
Yeah.
Oh god, I think it's more frustrating than being told that they will never do a remake of Battle Royale. Because American audiences will think that it's ripping off the Hunger Games. And
oh, is that the excuse they were using? They're using now.
Yeah.
See, because the excuse they used throughout all the 2000s was school shootings, Columbine. Yeah. You know, it's just we've been having more school shootings lately. I thought we'd probably go back to that one, but oh yeah, no, it was oh god, when those Hunger Games movies came out over here, there were so many uppity people like, hey, it's just a ripoff of Battle Royale. And it's like, yeah, it's a ripoff of Battle Royale in the same way I bet you didn't watch 28 Days Later because that's a ripoff of Dawn of the Dead. You know?
I think the most frustrating part is the fact Suzanne Collins, who actually wrote the Hunger Games book, said she'd never heard of Battle Royale. And I'm thinking, the most popular Japanese movie that people who don't even like subtitle movies have heard and seen, and you've never heard of it.
It's not... Actually, not. Well, I was going to say Saratine Tiger, Hidden Dragon, but that's like China, Hong Kong. Yeah, I don't know. It's Japanese, Asian movies over here. I don't know about Britain, if they're more of a... I don't know if they're less of a kind of like a cult thing in Britain, but even the most mainstream, even the ones that get the most mainstream attention, Asian films over here are still cult films.
Yeah.
You know, so I can completely believe Suzanne Collins you know, I don't know Suzanne Collins. I don't know what her interests are. All I know is she wrote the Hunger Games books. If she's just like a regular, like, normal human being that likes watch the Bachelor and stuff and, you know, American Idol, then I can completely believe she's never heard of Battle Royale. It's, you know, I've barely heard of, but I've had opportunities to see Battle Royale. I just haven't. You know, it's one of those things that you kind of have. It's not one of those things that you're going to have someone blast at you over here. You know, you're just not, you know, paying any attention, and boom, Battle Royale.
That really surprised me. I would have thought that you'd seen it.
Yeah, I don't. I think I tried to watch it at one point, and it kind of bored me. But this would have been years and years ago.
Okay.
I mean, there's always kind of like a little subsection of, you know, people interested in Asian cinema, but for the most part, you know, you have your horror people and they're interested in Miike and stuff like that, and then you have anime people. You don't really, and you know, Battle Royale doesn't really. I don't know if I should say it doesn't really fit in either place, but I mean, it doesn't seem to. It was fairly well known for a while. It's had a reputation for a while, and I think it's kind of gone back underground.
Yeah. I think when it comes to Asian, well, it comes to any sort of foreign cinema, it's more a sort of title-by-title basis. You can never tell what's going to take off. I mean, like you were saying, I mean, there's certain directors like Miike, who obviously had it with, when you look at his outlaw period, there's a lot of films in there which obviously appeal to the horror crowds, things like Audition and Dead Alive and Ishii the Killer. Yeah.
Yeah,
and I think he's
Happiness of the Katakuris.
Yeah,
you know, stuff like that.
I think it, and he was also sort of fortunate when a lot of his films sort of came across like during the big J horror boom,
right?
So like things like Ring and stuff, and I think that's how those films sort of got picked up, because they obviously appeal to the horror crowd and because of the big movement at the time, but. When it comes to foreign cinema, I mean, it's really a title-by-title basis. Some titles get picked up by the mainstream, some don't. You can never really tell, but for some reason, right. Battle Royale really struck a chord. I mean, then again, I mean, the Brits really love Donnie Darko. We totally dug Reservoir Dogs, and this is the thing, Reservoir Dogs in America was released as a little art house movie, and then it came over to Britain, and it was sort of like, this movie's big, and it got all this hype, and then it went back to America as this like big title. And the same with Donnie Darko did some middling business, came over to Britain, huge cult following, we were like real big, like Darko, like fans over here, and then suddenly,
you know, kind of like, you know, Frankenstein, Darko,
it's like, oh, Darko, know. It's something about Donnie Darko really appealed to the British sensibility, and then
I think it's all the British 80s music,
possibly.
You know, the Tears for Fears, the Joy Division. I think there's some Echo and the Bunnymen in there. You know,
I think
it's a very. I mean, the thing about that film is that it has a very. It's an American film. It takes place in America. It's got stars American actors. It's made by an American filmmaker. But there is something like kind of like almost European about it, the way it's done. Yeah. Like there's something like vaguely in a sense that I can't really put my finger on, so that I can completely understand. There's like a kind of like an existentialism to it that the American mainstream just doesn't get, but that like Western Europeans, Brits, the French, the Germans, you can just see them going gaga over it.
Yeah. I think Richard Kelly is one of those directors that I've probably got into more arguments defending his work than any other director. Southland Tales, I think I've ruined friendships defending that movie. So like potential friendships have just been destroyed by someone saying, but you'd be all fine. And then someone just go, oh, Southland Tales makes no sense. And then it's just like, it sort of like triggers that thing where you go into like a 30-minute rant about why you just don't get this genius of it, and we should have the original cut, and It tends to sort of black out and you just like wake up and you come to in like this empty bar of you just by yourself, just panting and sweating.
Just you know, the bartenders are just, you know, what might be less than we had to go to Ben South. Well, damn again, didn't you?
It's like, fun times. But speaking of cool things, I mean, on to the first of our selections tonight. We are going to look at Aeon Flux to begin with. And this was your pick, Lackey. I mean, what is it about Aeon Flux that you love so much?
I got to kind of go back to, like the early 90s on this one. This was back in the, probably about 91, 92, MTV had put on this show that was basically, it was called Liquid Television. It was basically kind of like this avant-garde compilation of, animation, little animated clips, a lot of which were called from Spike and Mike, second Twisted Festival of Animation. And they had all this sort of weird, bizarre stuff that this was the early 90s, and this was, you know, when there was still kind of like this niche for this kind of weird stuff. There was a lot of kind of like a market for a lot of things that I don't know if you'd have necessarily a market for them now, but it was, you know, this was when Lollapalooza was big over here and like the Jim Rose circus. And anyway, one of the things they always had in these segments of Liquid Television was they had this, you know, 3 or 4 minute long thing called Aeon Flux, which, you had really no, there was really, you know, if you were like 17 and you had never heard of William Gibson or Bruce Sterling and you hadn't really, you know, you might have heard of Akira, but if this was kind of even a point where I don't think that the anime crowd, the otaku community had really started to coalesce in America. It's just this bizarre thing that the likes of which you would have never seen before. It's just really, from a visual standpoint, it's like a cross between anime. It's got a definite anime influence, but it's also the other big influence I see on it is Mobius, the Jean Giraud, the French, the late French cartoonist. Who contributed very heavily to heavy metal. It was completely silent. There was no dialogue, and you kind of had to work out. I mean, it was the first season across the first season of Liquid Television. It was serialized, so you'd only get 2 minutes at a time, and trying to piece together what was going on, this whole sort of dystopian thing, was, you know, it was. You know, a lot of the kind of things that we get now from like watching a show like Lost is kind of what you had to do, you know, at the beginning. And back here, you know, we would have on our public TV stations, we would have shows that would have these kind of experimental short films and or like, you know, music videos and stuff like that. And it was just kind of a piece with that. And I always found that kind of stuff fascinating. And the two things that came out of Liquid Television were Aeon Flux, and then they had a short animated film by a guy named Mike Judge called Frog Baseball, which was about these two snickering morons playing baseball with a frog instead of a ball, and that of course turned out to be Beavis and Butthead. And to that day, to this very day, it's like I'm not really much of a fan of Beavis and Butthead itself. I kind of like the movie. I kind of like Do America. But like the show, never really could get into the show.
Yeah.
Obviously, as we found out a couple months ago, I love Dari to bits. But Beavis and Butthead never got into it. But that first short, two. 3 minute long thing. Frog baseball. And it was just like, that was like for like 30 people, that was like the first they'd ever seen of anything like this.
Yeah. But Beavis and Butthead, I think for myself, it was the music videos I liked the best.
Yeah.
And now they've actually, they on the latest season that they did, they also comment on their MTV shows as well. And it's great, the humor transfers across, but they were always the funniest when they were just talking about music, when they were doing their commentary for like the music videos. And I think that's where I got a lot of my musical sort of taste from, was watching Beavis and Beds for like the music videos.
And a lot of that's the case for a lot of people. I know a lot of people really dig that. I never did. I was just like, frog baseball, you know. So in 95, you know, they basically, MTV ordered a series of Aeon Flux, like proper half hour episodes of Beavis and Butthead. And they only ever did the one season of Aeon Flux. And it's very different from the Liquid Television episodes, because they actually have plots and there's dialogue. There's not really a whole lot of continuity from episode to episode, but it's a sort of like prisoner style dystopia where there's always this sort of kind of like a double talk where people are always like, to take this episode, and the episode we watched was the first episode of what is generally considered to be season 3, but is actually the only season of like half hour episodes. And the name of the episode is Utopia or Deuteranopia. Deuteranopia, I looked it up, it means colorblindness. And in it, it basically is, if you don't know who Aeon Flux is, Aeon Flux is kind of like a terrorist / assassin / mercenary who dresses in very skimpy leather outfits and has this sort of, there's this sort of two fictional countries, Brenia and Monica. And she's an agent of the Nation of Monica, and she has this sort of weird love, lust, hate relationship going on with this Brennan, or Breen politician, I guess you'd call him, this lanky David Bowie-esque figure named Trevor Goodchild. And there's this sort of kind of, I wouldn't say undefined, but very ambiguous sort of sexual tension between the two. They're always kind of trying to one-up each other, but there's like really like a lot of sexual tension between the two. And it shifts. The interesting thing about Aeon Flux, it will shift from episode to episode, like what their relationship is. There's not a whole lot of continuity. So in this first episode, Trevor Goodchild takes control. He overthrows. He stages the kidnapping, the abduction of Brenya's figurehead, Clavius, and assumes power for himself. And in something I'm not really entirely clear on, somehow opens up a portal into Clavius's body, where he has this sort of like Black Lodge type thing, where he wants to keep Aeon for his own. And then there's this sort of plot, there's another, and it's a very twisty plot. And even reading like the synopsis, I'm not really entirely sure how everything comes together. There's, you know, Aeon Flux gets involved. There's this other guy named Gildemir who knows, you know, that Trevor has kidnapped the leader and has assumed power for himself, you know, knows all this stuff. And it's just very surreal. It's like I said, it's got this very sort of surreal aspect to it. It's like The Prisoner, like I said, in that it seems to have a meaning, but you can't always necessarily tell what the meaning is, what the message is. Sometimes things change from episode to episode. You know, the thing that really kind of struck me is this whole thing where, Trevor Goodchild is like, there will be openness now, there will be transparency. And it's obviously the more that he talks about transparency, you know, the more secretive and opaque he actually is, you know, which for some reason, reminds me of our current political situation. But what did you think?
Aeon Flux is something I remember without even realizing what it was at the time. This was the original pilot was shown just as a random piece of animation on BBC Two. Is they would have like their post tea time little block, and they'd show like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and other sort of teenage demographic style programs, and like Ren and Stimpy was included amongst this. And they, I remember them showing the short, and I remember them showing the Pixar short Tin Toy as well in this little animation block that they had, and I remember it just stuck with me for years afterwards. And it, I can't remember where it turned up. They showed this clip again, and it was like, oh, this is Aeon Flux. And everyone like raving about how it triggered their sexual awakening as children and whatnot, which is quite clear to see when you look at the character of Aeon, who's basically this leather-clad dominatrix-style character who can do all this amazing gymnastics and spends as much time seducing her targets as she does killing them. Something that really appeals to me about Aeon Flux, though, is the fact that it is so similar to heavy metal, which you mentioned already, and certainly something I think we both said we're fans of, especially the original film. And that's what this basically feels like you're watching an extension of. Because this story that we saw, I mean, this could easily fit within the context of that first original heavy metal film. Certainly the art style is very similar to Mobius, and it's an art style which doesn't really follow any sort of rules or logic. It just sort of free flows, which is really kind of wonderful to watch, especially as it moves. It suits the, you know, the movements and the style of this character. And I mean, obviously, just watching this one, it actually did inspire me to go back and watch like the original shorts, because the original shorts, there's no dialogue in them at all. It's just like, this is free form animation that as Aeon carries out various missions, and she dies in pretty much all of them, which is kind of jarring the first couple of times it happens. So, but yeah, I really like it. I'm not sure I really understood what was going on in this episode, but it had some good energy to it. Yeah, I'm glad that you also picked up on the Red Room reference there. especially as he's like running through these curtains, and it's like, woman, this is just the end of Twin Peaks. this is kind of surreal. But I kept like waiting for like this moment where it was all going to become clear, and it never really happens. And I think this is the thing which is going to make this such a diverse show, is the fact that you're either going to enjoy its experimental nature, or you're just going to find it a little too surreal. And I think it's going to be very diverse to the newcomer in that way. Certainly I can see why it got its appeal, especially on something like Liquid Television, that sort of experimental animation block. And certainly if you're putting it against the likes of the original Beavis and Butthead Short Frog Baseball, I think it just perfectly fits within that sort of anarchic animation. And I mean, I was looking up the director to see what else he's done. I mean, he's worked on quite a number of properties which I'm aware of. Most in particular, he worked on the kids show Cops. I don't know if you ever saw that as a kid.
No.
Cops was basically this sort of futuristic show where you had all these like police, and they all had like special abilities and stuff. Like you had this character called Long Arm, who had the ability to shoot like grappling hook handcuffs, and it was, as I said, it was just a fun little show in sort of like very much in the vein of like SWAT Cats or something like that. It was sort of thing you watched over in the like school holidays. But I mean, he also worked on Rolf Bakshi's Fire and Ice. He did the Rugrats movie. He did Chronicles of Riddick: Dark Fury and the Meticulated segment for the Animatrix.
Yep, I remember. If you weren't really paying attention to his name, and you weren't aware of all the other stuff he was doing, I remember when people were talking about the Animatrix when that came out. The big thing was, oh, the guy who created Aeon Flux is doing a segment for the Animatrix.
I mean, I love the Animatrix. I didn't know until we were doing the research for this that he was involved in it, so that was kind of lost on me. But no, there's so many elements of the Animatrix I really, really love. I mean, I love the fact that he's had Production IG doing stuff in there. Just the general blending of styles that the Animatrix did. I know, but it might be something we look at in a future episode, because I think, because it was released as a show over here in the UK prior to the the second Matrix movie, and there's so many interesting elements to the Animatrix, like so many of the Wachowski properties. I mean, you kind of dismiss them on a surface level, and when you start getting deeper into them, they have all these interesting sort of layers to them. But
the thing about the Wachowskis, and I remember, this is something I remember actually writing about when I wrote a capsule review of Jupiter Ascending. It's the problem with them is not that they're shallow. The problem is that they have way too many ideas.
Yeah.
And they're influenced by way too many things, and there's really nobody behind the scenes saying, you need to back up and maybe rein yourself in a little bit. They're definitely, you do see all these influences from, I mean, you know, anime and various animation and comic books. You know, Jupiter Ascending is basically like 20 years of comic book continuity in 2.5 hours. You know, and obviously the anime influenced these are the people who did a Speed Racer movie. I'm glad that they're out there doing stuff. You know, I'm absolutely glad that they're out there doing stuff. A lot of their stuff doesn't seem to quite catch on beyond kind of like a cult audience. And I think that's a shame, but I don't really know. Yeah, I guess you can only throw so much money at something before, you know, you need some sort of, you know, general return on it.
I think this is the problem with the Wachowskis is that they're independent filmmakers who need the mainstream dollars to make their visions.
Yeah.
And like you said, they've got so many interesting ideas, but like, again, you said, they need to pull it back or just need someone to call bullshit sometimes.
Right.
Because, I mean, there were so many elements. I mean, if we just take like the third Matrix movie, for example, the logical ending of that would have been that he ends up back in Cubicle Hell. That you cut out this whole techno Jesus malarkey, and you have like the battle with Smith, and that his reward for defeating it is that he ends up back in the cube, where he's back where he started, not this bizarre ending that sort of we don't know how to end this that they basically went with. And I think as time goes on, we're going back and we're looking at their films and we're seeing. We're reviewing them again. I mean, like Speed Racer was dismissed critically when it came out, and now people are going back and reassessing it. The same now with Cloud Atlas. I think Jupiter Ascending is going to take a little more time because there's a lot of Drek in there.
At the very least, I hope that we learn to appreciate Eddie Redmayne's performance in that film as the millennial equivalent of Brian Blessed in Flash Gordon.
True.
You know, that's just, people would always talk about how bad he was in that film, and it's like, I will take him over practically anybody else in the film, because at least he's doing something. I mean, Sean Bean looks bored, Tuppence Middleton is like, okay, if I show you my butt, can I get on with my life now? You know?
With Aeon Flux, I mean, do you think that this is something that could come back for like the millennial generation, or do you think that it's so fondly remembered because of it being released during that key time?
I think it's something that could be very much of its time. I don't know if it's, see, part of the appeal of it at the time was that, and I said this earlier, but I want to stress it again, we had never seen anything like it like that before, unless you had the connections and were aware of what was being done in, like, you know, what was even at that point still called Japanimation.
Yeah.
You know, if you were lucky, you'd heard of Akira. You know, you wouldn't have actually have seen it, but you would have heard of it. So at that point, the only thing that you would have for a reference is the Heavy Metal movie. And I think today, that the sort of things that these sort of wild ass things I think are a lot easier to come by. It's a lot easier. I mean, when you have entire streaming platforms dedicated to anime, not that this is anime, although there's definitely an anime, a little bit of an anime influence here. But this sort of weird sort of thing, it's of its time. I think there's an audience for it. But, I mean, it only ran for, 10 episodes in 1995, the full series. So, arguably, it may not have even really found an audience back at the time. Mm. It's definitely a product of its time. I don't think it really has maybe, like, the more broader appeal of a Beavis and Butthead. But there's always going to be... There's probably always going to be somebody, like, an audience for it. Growing up, the next generations, it's going to be passed on from, you're going to pass it on to your kids. I'm going to pass it on to my goddaughter, and her parents are going to look at me like I'm some sort of pervert and stuff like that. But I think it's always going to be a cult thing. I think it's always going to be a little bit of a minority interest. I think the fact that they did a film little over 10 years ago that there was just about no interest in. And I think that really kind of at the time, that there was no interest really in the Aeon Flux live action film really speaks volumes.
And I obviously have to ask as well, I mean, obviously as you being the established fan, do you prefer like the second series, which is like the 30-minute long episodes and there's dialogue, or do you prefer the more abstract sort of 6-minute episodes that were like the second season, where she just basically dies and runs around a lot?
They both have their own kind of special appeal to me.
Okay.
I don't know if I would really say I have one or the other. There's a certain sort of kind of anything goes when you know that you can, when you go into the first couple batches of episodes knowing that kind of anything that can happen, that's very, very exhilarating, knowing that she can die and stuff like that. Not again that there's even, amongst the third episodes of the proper 30-minute episodes, not that there's even a lot of continuity there, but there is a sort of, and I like abstract stuff. I like stuff that doesn't have a plot, or that it's kind of like a mystery that I kind of got to figure out for myself or come up with my own interpretation. But then again, there's this sort of, there's a lot of those elements are also present in the half-hour series that have dialogue. And they're just as mysterious. I know a lot of people probably do think that having the characters talk and live between episodes maybe kind of defeats the purpose, but I don't know. I like them both. I think they both have their own appeal.
Yeah, I just love the original short where she's there like this invincible assassin. She's like gunning down with dual machine guns all these soldiers, and it's like a tack to the foot that causes her to fall off a cliff and break her neck. It's like
right.
That's what brings her down. She's an invincible until a bloody drawing pin takes her down.
Right, and again, kind of going funny. Into that knowing, it's kind of like, the early South Park, knowing in it going that Kenny dies of every episode. That gives you sort of kind of like a weird sort of exhilaration, the knowing that anything can happen. Until it becomes a formula, which luckily we never kind of got to the point where it became a formula.
Yeah, I think I still, the first time I saw that pilot, and it has that ending, I was like, I wasn't expecting that, so.
Right.
It's certainly a bit different, and I don't know, I like this, but at the same time, I wouldn't bring it back. I think now, when we look at this sort of, the animation that this would have fallen into, because at the time, I mean, this would have been put alongside, as you said, Frog Baseball, Ren and Stimpy, Rocko's Modern Life, and now when we look at the things which inhabit that area where it's sort of moved on from, I mean, Space Ghost Coast to Coast, Teen Hunger Force, I mean, now it's moved on to things like Rick and Morty, Mr. Pickles. These sort of more adult animations that are very clear on what they are.
Right.
And I just don't think that Aeon would fit in that much. I mean, it's great having it as this block of animation that it is, and I think it still holds up where it is, but I just don't think there's a place to bring it back.
No, I think you're right about that.
But yeah, I would still urge everyone to check it out. I think it's really cool. It's still
yeah.
I think certainly if you're a fan of anime especially, because this is really heavily influenced by anime, but as you said, like, I mean, anyone who was watching this at the time, I don't think would have made that connection. They're more likely to connect it more to heavy metal than they would to anime.
And even if they connected it to that, I mean, if you're just some rando that's, you know, happens to have MTV on when this is on, you know, you might not even at that, like, again, at that point, it wasn't, you know, at that point, I don't even think I discovered heavy metal by the time I'd actually seen EM. I think I found EM Flux before I found heavy metal.
Yeah.
Because again, this was before the internet, and this was, you know, to find cult films, you know, it took a lot more work back then. You know, you had to know people, and you had to read things. You know, it's not like you could just enter it into Google and, you know, have 70, Takashi Miike films spit back out at you. You know, you had to put some elbow grease into it.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, some days I'm pining for that thrill of discovery, and then other days I just realize that I kind of like having that accessibility to stuff without, you know, having to make 6 deals and get some tape that's like been recorded. It's like it's 6 generation recording and fuzzy as hell in places. But
it's one of those things where it's like I accept that I will never again have that sort of feeling of exhilaration when I was, you know, I'm a sheltered suburban kid. I'm a sheltered suburban man now, but you know, I was a sheltered suburban kid. I lived in the suburbs. I didn't go to the city a lot, you know, so when I did go to the city and I would go to like a Tower Records or a used record store or whatever, and I would look through the stuff and I would, here's the Joy Division video. Here are the Young Men. And you would get that sort of kind of like feeling of like the thrill of you found something.
Yeah.
You know, you found something. You found an obscure 808 State 12-inch single. You found a bizarre movie that you had seen in the middle of the night, you know, on a UHF station. You'd found this. And, you know, I'm never going to get that exhilaration again necessarily. But on the other hand, you know, when I do go to a movie and it's you know, when I do get the, and it really kind of does, you know, put the thumb on whatever pressure points that these things get with me, you know, when I do, you know, when I do go and I see a movie like, you know, Annihilation or The Witch or, you know, The Black Coat's Daughter, or when I discover a new band that just, you know, puts chills up my spine like Savages, you know, it's just, I don't get that as much anymore, but it's still there.
We're going to take a quick break now. When we return, though, we will be looking at our second selection for this evening as we look at The Young Ones.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we're going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com, or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
And we're back. You are, of course, listening to TV Good Sleep Bad here on the ThatMomentIn.com podcast network. If you haven't done already, please do hit that subscribe button. It does help. Or leave some comments, whether you're listening to us on iTunes or Podomatic or Stitcher or anywhere where good podcasts can be found. We also are on Facebook and Twitter, so make sure you follow us and leave us some comments about the show. Let us know what you like, shows you want to see. It's all appreciated. We're now going to obviously talk about our second selection this evening, and that is The Young Ones, a key piece of British sitcom, and really one which paved the way for the likes of Bottom, and emerged out of a very revolutionary time in British comedy, this being released in 1985. And certainly when we look at the episodes that we're going to be talking about tonight, Bambi, it really, I think it pretty much featured the who's who of British alternative comedy at the time. And I mean we've talked about The Young Ones before. I mean, what is it about The Young Ones that you like so much?
It is the most anarchic. It's the most anarchic comedy show I've seen since Monty Python. There's a certain sort of insane, anything can happen comedy that really only the British can do. We can't do it very well, and it only comes along once in a lifetime, you know, in Britain. And it is really like an anything goes type thing. I mean, you take the plot to Bambi, which, you know, starts off with this whole thing, you know, which starts off with, I'll start with everybody kind of piling on Rick Mayall, and then goes into this plot about, one of Adrian Edmonton's socks, gaining sentience and running around. And then everybody goes on, you know, University Challenge. Motorhead shows up. They play a song while the young ones go through this sort of, I don't know what the hell they're doing, but they just go on and like steal tea and candy bars and stuff like that. And, you know, it's insane. There's no. You know, Alexei Thale shows up for a moment and talks about revolutionaries and cookies. And, you know, Griff Rhys-Jones plays Bambi, like, from the Disney movies. And it's just, there's this other kind of plot that I'm not entirely sure how it, you know, connects to everything else, which involves, like, this, Victorian scientist played by Robbie Coltrane, and he's got an eclair or a donut or something, and it falls on people. You know, it's just anything can happen, and usually does. I mean, yes, a lot of the appeal of this one particular episode is it does have Robbie Coltrane and Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry and Emma Thompson and Griff Rhys-Jones and Mel Smith, all before they became famous.
Oh, yeah. It also features Ben Elton and Tony Robinson as well.
I must have missed... Yeah, I got Ben Elton. I was kind of skipping Ben Elton because Ben Elton actually writes the show, writes this particular show. I missed Tony Robinson, but yeah. Ben Elton, just the way he says, "Oh, my daddy bought me the Socialist Workers Party." You know, this wonderful bit where Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry and Ben Elton and Emma Thompson are playing, basically, they're playing like the heirs of the Monty Python Upper Class Quid of the Year sketch. You know, they're going on, they're representing Footlights College, Oxbridge. You know, and they have these questions at University of Challenge, like, who's the richest man in the world? And then Lord Snot, who's played by Stephen Fry, it's me, isn't it? I mean, it's just one thing I love to do with people is, or at least I love to do to people probably about 8 or 9 years ago, was say, "Hey, you know the guy that's on House?" And they'd say, "Yeah." And then I'd show them that bit, and I'd show them, Hugh Laurie's character, and they'd be like, "What?" You know, I mean, but it's like that was like you. I mean, you even had the reference to, you know, not the 9 o'clock news. I think that maybe the one person you were, you know, missing is Rowan Atkinson, and that's about it. You know, everything. You know, there's a, you know, they have a fight with a washing machine, and, you know, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Okay. I mean, if you're not familiar with The Young Ones, and I think we kind of got, we let our excitement for this show get ahead of ourselves. Basically, The Young Ones are these four undergrad students who are sharing a house, and it's very much a forerunner for Bottom in its setup. And if you look at the set, they're pretty much the same set. And you have, basically, you've got an aggressive punk medical student called Vivian Bastard, played by Adrian Edmondson. You've got the anarchist sociology student Rick, played by Rick Mail. You've got the paranoid hippie and peace study student Neil, who's played by Natural Planet. And you've got the wannabe underground mob boss, Mike, played by Christopher Ryan, who I think outside of this is probably best known for showing up in as an alien in Doctor Who.
Yeah, he's a son. He did a couple episodes where he played a Sontaran. He's not the lead Sontaran. That's Dan Starkey. But yeah, apparently Chris Ryan is only like 5 feet tall, which is something that I meant to miss until watching this episode, and then noticed that Nigel Planer like towers over him.
Yeah,
and who I had always assumed was very short, because he's kind of got that sort of. Everybody picks on everybody on this show. But he's kind of got that sort of like demeanor, that sort of like kind of like meekish demeanor. So I always assumed that he was very short, but no, apparently like he's only 5 foot two. Chris Ryan is. So, yeah, so he's perfect for playing a Sontaran who have Sontarans have low centers of gravity. I'm a complete nerd.
Okay. and as you mentioned already, we got Alexis Ellis ready. So we've got like, a lot of people that were in the underground comedy scene. I mean, this episode basically gathers them all together. The only people missing, as you mentioned already, is the fact that we are missing Lenny Henry, who isn't in this. French and Saunders, who did obviously turn up in other episodes. And
Rowan Atkinson.
Who were basically, at the time, was doing Not the 9 o'clock News. And like Blackadder. And, I mean, this episode did. It's so manic. I mean, the whole point of the episode is they're going on a university challenge. But to get there, the first half is just this, them basically going on this surreal improv journey. It's kind of like you're watching an improv set, and they've basically got this one set, and they can do whatever they want within this one set, and they just basically making up as they go along, as it feels like. Such as the fact there's one scene where they're like, oh, we've got to go to the laundrette, but wait a minute, it's midnight, so let's go, we'll go to bed. So you just see them march upstairs, and they come down, and they've all swapped characters.
Yeah.
Which I just thought was brilliant. The fact that you've got, as I said, you've got Christopher Ryan playing Nigel Planner's character, so he's dressed as a hippie, and he's gone from being the, you got the tallest character, is now the smallest character. You got Rick Mail playing Vivian, who just gurns his way through.
And it's hilarious, because it took me a while to realize what had happened. It's like, something's different here, and I'm not sure. And it wasn't until Rick Mayall, who had done such a good job of kind of like imitating Adrian Edmondson's facial expressions, pulls an obvious Rick Mayall face, that I realize what's happened.
Yeah. I mean, before this, we've got one of Vivian's socks comes to life and leads them on a chase around the house. They go to the laundrette, and there's a scene where the laundry machines are refusing to take Vivian's clothes because they're so disgusting. And you can basically see it's just Ade Edmondson and Rick Mills rocking a washing machine, pretending it's alive. But they're doing it with such energy that you think, oh, this is like a really impressive effect. But no, it's just these two guys rocking a washing machine and pretending it won't take clothes. And I mean, this is even before we get on to the random appearance of Motorhead, who provide the the musical improv. And while this is going on, we've got the same improv happening, but now at a London station, as they basically go around and causing chaos and flipping the V's and... But when we get to the actual university challenge and we get to see Ade Edmondson's pet hamster, which has got a Scottish accent for no apparent reason, and it headbutts the rival school's mascot, and we get Alexi Sale doing his, as I said, his bit on was it revolutionaries and how they become inspiration for biscuits like the Garibaldi. Yeah. It's just so fun. I mean, the fact that the episode, it takes his name Bambi from the fact that we are led to believe that Bambi, yes, the animated deer, was saved by Mike and got a job now working as a TV presenter in human form.
Yeah.
And it's played by, I mean, is it Griffreece Jones? Or am I getting...
It's Griffreece Jones. Mel Smith is the, Mel Smith is the guy that, they pull the, Vivian has a pet ferret. Which he claims is so deformed as to make it look like a pig. And it's named Bacon Sandwich, which is a very weird name for a ferret.
I mean, that's just really just... It just really says it all, really. The fact that you've got conversations where they're convincing a security guard that a pig is a ferret, and the effect is called Bacon Sandwich, and... But let's look at the rival school here. I mean, obviously we've got Hugh Laurie, Stephen Fry, Ben Elton, and Emma Thompson who are playing this rival school. I mean Stephen Fry. I mean, what's your feelings on Stephen Fry? Because I know he's the favourite of the students, and I've sort of had my Stephen Fry moment and moved on from it.
Stephen Fry. He's like all these other people on this show. I mean, it's really kind of, well, I shouldn't say it's like Mel Smith is dead, and I don't know what, you know, Griffreece Jones has gone on to, but it's like going through everybody. It's like it's a really kind of like watching Stephen Fry in something now is very different from like watching him in this or watching him in an episode of Blackadder, for the same reason that watching Hugh Laurie in this or watching him in an episode of that by her is very different from watching him in House or The Night Manager or anything like that. It's just, I think they're all talented people. I like Stephen Fry. Stephen Fry, apart from his, you know, life as an actor, apart from being an actor, he's also kind of like a cultural commentator. And he does, and he's, you know, he goes and he has comment, you know, he's a very intelligent guy. You know, he's not just a comedian. He's not just a comic actor. And he does have, he's something of a bit of a nerd heartthrob over here, despite being gay, or perhaps because he's gay, partially. There was this one song that a friend of mine played me that had been written, a young woman had written a song about how she wanted to have Stephen Fry's babies.
Okay.
But I mean, you know, I'm pro Stephen Fry.
I mean, I like Stephen Fry from a comedy perspective. I certainly like him in this episode. I think now he's become this academic figure, and I think it's this student element, and the fact that we now have the student element who basically anything student Stephen Fry says is gospel, and it's the most important and truthful statement ever. It's sort of like if I have to see that whole Stephen Fry on God video again, I'm going to lose my mind. Because in Stephen Fry's world, that, you know, God is infallible, and that what sort of, how you can have God, because we have things like death and murder and famine and disease, and this idea that this figure could allow this to happen. And I mean, it totally disregards the fact that you can't paint a masterpiece in bright colors, and that life requires struggle in order to achieve greatness. I mean, you only have to look at Proust, who, when he gets to the end of his life and looks back, and he realizes that all the struggle was the bits that he actually learned stuff about himself. All the times he was happy, he didn't learn anything at all. It was worthless. It inspired nothing. And according to Stephen Fry, we should have none of this, and it should all be, if God like probably existed, he would not allow any of this to happen, and everything would be the perfect utopia, and all these student types tend to love plugging this and how it dispels God and all this. And I'm thinking, just no.
I don't know. I'm not going to say you don't have a point, because you certainly do, but it's like, I think almost every other, that's something that pretty much all the major cultural commentator, people who have either been thrust into the role of cultural commentator or have thrust themselves into that role, you know, are kind of like, you know, kind of have that problem. Certainly Richard Dawkins has that problem. Richard Dawkins, now mind you, Richard Dawkins certainly has kind of like the scientific cred that Stephen Fry doesn't necessarily have.
Yeah.
But like Richard Dawson has that too. Dawkins, not Richard Dawson. He was he was the host of Family Feud. Richard Dawkins has that to a degree. Even Neil deGrasse Tyson has a little bit of that. Brian Cox, I think, has a little the astronomer, not the Scottish actor. You know, it's just, I think it's something that kind of comes with the terror. Or even Charlie Brooker in his role as a commentator, as opposed to as a writer of television shows,
yeah,
you know, can be a little bit kind of like of the insufferable git that gets taken a little bit too seriously. I mean, but that's the point is when you're a student, you're still trying to figure. I mean, when you're a student, you're still trying to figure this stuff out. You do tend to take things very literally, you know. You do tend to take things one side literally, and hopefully, if you do things right, as you get older, you get some experience, and you kind of figure out that things aren't as cut and dried as all that. You know, there are certainly, I think he brings up some very good points in that God video. I don't think it's the complete and utter demolition of theology that a lot of people make it out to be.
Yeah.
You know, there's certainly as things that, you know, I don't think he destroys Christianity in 2 minutes in that. But it is something that you do sit and think about. And it's, you know, like I said, hopefully, if you know, you've done your job correctly, if you teach yourself how to think, or if you learn and how to think for yourself, then it's maybe it's part of the journey into kind of figuring out where you actually stand on things.
Yeah.
You know, and for the most part, I find it fairly entertaining, and you know, for the most part, his kind of philosophies line up with my kind of philosophies. That doesn't mean I agree with him on everything, but, you know, at least he's not Bill Maher.
True. The Young Ones is such a unique series. I mean, the fact it exists in its own surrealist plane. Alexis Sells' moments in this are like these random interludes. I mean, there's an episode where he's the head of police by day, a Eurovision Song Contest by night. The fact he get, I mean, I don't, Alexis Sells is really sort of the forerunner of this whole generation of comedians. And he actually made a really interesting sort of criticism back in like 2013. And he said that this episode had a detrimental effect on the UK alternative comedy scene of the 1980s, as the guest stars were prominent members of the established Cambridge Footlights, in contrast to Sales Marxist learnings, or leanings, shall I say?
Alexi Sale wrote an essay that I've been trying to get on my grubby little hands on for years. He wrote it back in the 80s, and it was called Why Should Be the Next Doctor Who? The Case for a Marxist in the TARDIS. And, no, yeah, I'm definitely aware of like Alexi Sale's status as a political, capital P political, and specifically Marxist comedian, which always kind of struck me as kind of funny that he ended up that he's probably the one who's probably stayed like the purest out of everybody else here, because, you know, Rick Mayall. Well, I mean, I shouldn't say necessarily the actual people who are on The Young Ones, but like Hugh Laurie, Emma Thompson, and Stephen Fry went off to be proper actors. Ben Elton went on to write the Queen musical, and I think he wrote the ABBA musical as well. And then you take a look at the sort of the other equivalent of Ben Elton, who is Richard Curtis, who wrote Blackadder. And Richard Curtis, you know, writes these days, he writes Turk and romantic comedies. And it's just, there's just been this sort of whole, you know, sort of selling out type thing, I guess. And it's, I don't know, I guess I can't really blame them. I guess, you know, you got to work. But yeah, it's a sort of thing where looking at it kind of now, kind of looking at what everybody else has done and then looking at Alexei Sale, who's pretty much just my understanding is that he's basically a writer now. He doesn't really perform anymore, and he does columns, and he writes novels, and he writes books and essays, and he's very much, you know, kept up these Marxist, and socialistic, philosophies, you know, which I find a little bit fascinating. But then again, I live in a country where, you know, socialism is a dirty word. You know, and if you can't call yourself, you can't actually go in public and call yourself a Marxist and still have a career. So, I mean, that's just the thing that really kind of weirds me out. But again, it's this whole sort of, I think you put your finger on the button when you called it improv. You know, it's very much an anything goes type thing. It's very anarchic. You never know what's going to happen next. The characters are internally, you know, consistent, but there's no real, you know, halfway through the episode, they're riding on a train and Vivian says, I wonder why this sign says, do not stick head out of window. And he sticks his head out of the window and it kind of gets knocked off. He pulls the cord to stop the train and goes around, looks for his own severed head for like 3 minutes, you know, kicking it down the way. And, you know, his head is like, I'm over here, you bastard. You know, that's the kind of show it is. You know, it's not anything. It's not anything that's trying to be in any remote sense of the word, I guess, diegetic or realistic. You're never ever. I mean, it's very stagey. It's very theatrical. It's the sort of thing you can imagine people doing on stage.
Yeah.
And it's very cheap. Certainly, I think probably they probably spent the most money on Motorhead. This was, by the way, the first time I'd ever heard Motorhead when I first saw this episode, back in, I think, 86 or 87 when it was running on MTV. MTV was the counter. It was like the source of counterculture even then. MTV, I think, on Saturday or Sunday nights would run Monty Python, and they'd run a little bit of British comedy. They'd run this. They'd run the Young Ones because it had a very punk rock feel to it.
Yeah.
But they also ran Comic Strip Presents, which was a lot of the same people. Again, particularly Edmonton and Mayall, French and Saunders, Fry and Laurie, Rowan Atkinson, and so forth. I think that's really that's the appeal of it. Knowing that pretty much it's a lot more anarchic than Bottom is. Bottom doesn't quite have that sort of, it's more consistent, I guess, Bottom is.
I think with Bottom,
it's more internally, go on.
I think with Bottom is really just Emerson and Rick Mayall basically picking up where they left off with the Danger Brothers. And they incorporate elements of that act into the Young Ones, but obviously with Bottom, it was more that they were just like the two that were sort of taken aside, and they were given more of a free rein. With the Young Ones, it has, as I said, it's still got that slapstick, that sort of anarchic elements that Bottom has. But at the same time, it adds all these very surreal Monty Python style esque elements. The fact that there's a scene where we like zoom in on like a matchbook that suddenly speaks. We cut away from the activity in the flat to discover they're actually living in the slide of a Victorian scientist who's also a psychiatrist who is talking to an elephant that Tony Robinson's brought in for some bizarre reason.
And Tony Robinson is insistent that it's a human being, but the elephant itself will admit it's a talking elephant, and it will admit that it's an elephant. I mean, that is the sort of show you're dealing with here.
Yeah. And I just like Robbie Coltrane. Just Robbie Coltrane saying the word sticky buns.
Yeah.
I just find it immensely amusing. But that's... I remember watching this as a kid. This was the sort of show that, that your dad let you watch, but your mum didn't really approve of you watching. And it was sort of like, right, 9 o'clock on a Friday night on a BBC Two. You'd rush back from Scouts to watch The Young Ones and Bottom and Red Dwarf and these sort of comedies. But I remember The Young Ones, and just, I think, the fact that Motorhead randomly appear, and I mean, I liked Motorhead before, but the fact they just randomly appear as a music act, and the whole reason that The Young Ones included a musical act in the second series is so that they could get a bigger budget, because it meant that it wasn't classed as a comedy show, but a variety show, which meant the BBC would give them more money to make it.
Yeah.
So they included a lot of, like, counter sort of culture bands at the time. You had Madness, you had Motorhead. And, I mean, it's a full performance of the Ace of Spades that we have here. And I love Motorhead. I mean, this is the classic Motorhead lineup you got here. And Lemmy is just cool as sin. He is so damn cool.
Again, like I said, it was the first time I'd ever heard this. I'd never heard Motorhead before. I'd never heard this song before. I might have heard Eat the Rich before this, but this might have probably had been the first time I'd ever really noticed him. And it was just, it's just kind of a revelation. It's like the first time you hear the Ramones.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, you can do that with rock and roll. You can just strip away all the extraneous BS. And you can just go in there as a power trio or a power quartet, guitars, bass, drums, and you can just do straight ahead rock and roll and fast and loud, and it can be good and it can be cathartic. You know, it's just very, I mean, even if they were a metal band, they were a metal band in a punk sense.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like the first time, like I said, the first time I heard the Ramones, or the first time I heard The Clash. Oh, I can. This is sort of thing that's possible with rock and roll. Okay, you know. So it's kind of mind blowing in its own way.
Yeah, and certainly when you look at that performance here and what they're basically acting against the music. Because while this is going on, you've got them running riot at the station, but it's in tune with the music. So it's sort of like, okay, well, this is the music. Do what this inspires you to do. So it's sort of like, oh, Vivian's going to go and he's going to flip the V's and he's going to steal buns and Mike's just going to have a sherry. And the hippie's going to go and use a photo booth. It's just really random things. And you can tell that they basically just probably just showed up at, I don't know, Paddington or wherever and just thought, oh, we're just going to run around here and we'll just film it while we do it.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anyone had a clue what's supposed to be going on with these four characters, so...
I mean, there are three credited writers for this episode. I'm not sure anybody actually wrote it. Well, I mean, you'd have to have writers, because you'd have to pre-plan some of the stuff, like the Talking Matchbook. You know, you have to plan, but a lot of this just seemed, again, I keep going back to the thing that you said, which is improv. You know, it does a very good job of feeling like they're just making this stuff up as they go along.
Yeah. It's like they've been given points that they have to hit. So it's like, oh, we've got to get to the laundrette. We've got to get to the station. We've got to get to University Challenge. But what happens in between is completely up to you to fill in. And that's basically, it's like the most slimmest of outlines it feels that they have at times. And I think it feels all the more fresh because it doesn't feel obviously scripted. It feels that you're watching these people just struggle to deal with being in the same room as each other, and that because they can't cope, they react with violence, and that's what's so funny about it, is the fact that you've got four people trying to deal with things, but the only way they know is through violence and chaos. These are the rules that the house follows.
I always thought that it was amazing that Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmonton, as a comedic duo, had such longevity, you know, because they had neck before this, and obviously after this there was Bottom and Gestas Paradiso, because they really, their characters really, they did do real, a very good job of acting like they could not stand each other. Like they wanted, I mean, Rick Mayall was so absolutely brilliant at being just so smarmy and pretentious and just all around unlikable. You know, no matter what the character. You know, here it's just like, I want to punch him in this. You know, I want to punch him. At the beginning of the, when he's talking about the, telling the story that, you know, that Vivian and Mike are not paying attention to, just the way he says, Mary, you know, it's just like, I want to punch him in the face. I can totally understand why nobody likes him. You know, why none of them like each other. They're all idiots and they're all jerks. And they like I said, those two specifically kind of play that double act so well for so long that it's when I would see one of them outside that, you know, obviously the big example, Adrian Edmonton was just in The Last Jedi. But I saw one of the last movies Rick Mayall did before he passed away, which was this sort of a horror techno thriller called Errors of the Human Body, where he played a stuffy corporate executive. And it's just so, it's, that's Rick. And it's like, you totally, he's so stuck in your head playing, you know, the People's Poet or Richard type characters. That when you see them, and the same thing with Adrian Edmonton, that to me it's sort of like, oh.
Yeah, I think the longevity of these them as a pairing is the fact that they would do something like The Young Ones, and then they would go off and do different projects. They would do like little appearances here and there, like Rick Mel in particular. I mean, he did obviously do The Young Ones, and then he would like turn up in like Blackadder as these variations of Flash. So like in Blackadder 2, he's Lord Flashheart, and then in Blackadder Goes Forth, he comes back as Squadron Leader Lord Flashheart, even though he's basically the same character. And he, by the time we get into Bottom, I mean, Bottom's like 91. So there's been enough time there for people to sort of like forget the sort of anarchy. I mean, Young Ones ends in 84, so there's sort of like almost 10-year gap there, and then by the time Bottom comes, it feels fresh and again. It doesn't feel like the same person did the same thing again.
And if I recall correctly, he'd also gone to Mail had also gone to Hollywood and done Drop Dead Fred.
Yeah.
Or whatever, which flopped at the time, but apparently that is now something of a minor cult classic.
Maybe.
I know, I mean, I'm not saying for everyone, but it's like, I know a couple of people who are like, not X or Zillennials, but like actual card-carrying millennials, like people born in the late 80s, early 90s, who that's one of their favorite films.
Yeah.
It's just Drop Dead Fred? Really? Okay.
I think there's a certain element that appeals to certain Zenials. I think maybe the Bottom fans. For myself, it's got a good first half, and then it's got an overly serious second half. The scene on the houseboat is still one of the funniest things. Just him playing pirates on a houseboat is just great.
I've never seen it, actually. I've never seen it.
Yeah. I mean, it's him and Winona Ryder. They act well against each other.
Sorry, B.B. Cates. I remember it coming out. I remember, like, oh, that's the guy from the Young Ones. But it was... I don't know if it actually was, but it was kind of promoted as a kids' movie. And it kind of came out at a time when I was sort of trying to go get away from kids' movies. And there's a lot of things that kind of came out when I was in my early to mid-teens, going up from when I was about 12 to 16, that I have never – that are apparently – and not that I'm saying that this is a cultural touchstone for American kids, but there are a lot of things like that are from that era that were like – marketed to kids that I never saw because they were marketed to kids and I thought myself above them. So I never saw Drop Dead Fred.
Okay.
Because it looked like a kid's movie.
It falls in that weird... I'm not sure who it's meant for. Yes, it's an imaginary friend and there's certainly childish elements, and then you got scenes of him smearing dog shit on her mother's furniture. So, but yeah, Young Ones, I mean, I would say it's still as fresh now as it was when it was released. It's still, if you like anarchic comedy, I mean, if you like Rick and Morty, for example, you like things with a bit of edge to them, then The Young Ones still totally holds up. It's still as fantastic as it was, so.
Oh, yeah. It's still... Yeah, I still let my head off.
Brings us to the end of another episode of TV Good Sleep Bad. I mean, Lucky, where do you wish to go for your next episode?
I kind of want to go back to, since we did Garth Marenghi last episode, I kind of like have a an urge to kind of go back in a Matt Berry direction. So we're going to be doing an episode of the show he did in the late 2000s with Rich Qualtra, the Mighty Boosh, called Snuffbox. And we're going to do an episode called Brothers, which, if I recall correctly, also Noel Fielding is in it and Richard Iowati. And it's just all around. Alan Ford's in it, and it is... It's a thing. Whiskey! What about you?
For myself, I'm going to go with another Brit comedy. I'm going to go for the season 4, episode 4 episode of the It Crowd. With the episode Italian for Beginners, in which Moz becomes obsessed with an iPhone game, and Roy is obsessed with trying to find the source of a very unusual fire. So, yeah,
I love the IT crowd.
Obviously, if you haven't done already, please do like, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or if just thatmomentin.com, where you can find our complete archive of episodes. Also, please do leave us some comments, feedback on, you know, iTunes or Podomatic or wherever you happen to be listening for. We do appreciate any feedback, and the ratings also help raise the profile of this show as well. Lucky, obviously, have you got anything coming up at all?
Obviously, I do have a thing. I do have a thing that I wrote for the Lamb website. I wrote I wrote a probably rather long-winded and pretentious profile of Get Out as an Oscar nominee for Best Picture. It won't win, but I wrote a thing anyway. And it's at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Cool. Also, if you haven't done already, do check out the podcast network at thatmomentin.com. Currently at the moment, you can find such great things, such as Love One Cinema Recall, Vern is looking back at the favorite childhood movie moments. Over on Game Walk, we're going to be looking at Dooku Dooku Literature Club. And on the Asian Cinema Film Club, we've got the most recent pick, February, which was Sammo Hung's classic film, Pedicab Driver. So lots of exciting things to check out over on the podcast network over at thatmomentin.com. So definitely go check those shows out, show them some love as well. We will, of course, be back next month with the IT Crowd and Snuffbox. But until then, thank you, as always, to my co-host, Lucky.
Thank you.
And this is Edward Jones, signing off another edition. Remind you, as always, to keep it strange.